Okay. Test next week. No, I'm just kidding. That's not for us. Okay. No test next week. All right. So let's get started here. So what I wanted to do today was actually do some review, because there were lots of you who had some problems with the semaphore question, and I said I'll review semaphore. So one of the things I'm going to do is spend a little bit of time going back all the way to chapter 9 and reviewing the material we covered on semaphores. Okay, the other thing I want to do is review the project, see where you are. Let me again explain a little bit, because some of you have questions on this. Explain what the project is about. Okay. Let's have a quick discussion on where things are. Okay, I just want to make sure people are generally on track. Okay, so let's start with the project. Okay, so let me just pull up the course description here. Alright. So very quickly, as you know, what the project is supposed to have you do is build a memory allocator. Okay, and as I mentioned, the motivation for this project is the memory allocation discussion we've been having. Now, we have talked about how the operating system allocates memory to processes. Okay? Now, unless you modify the operating system, you can't really do a project on virtual memory or anything like that. So instead, what this project is about is how a library such as a malloc library actually allocates memory to applications as and when they require it. So the hope is, by understanding all the data structures you have to maintain and all the techniques you have to use, you get some feel for the kinds of things the operating system has to do. Now, of course, the OS has to do a lot more, but that's just to give you a feel for why you are doing this project. Okay. Now, we didn't really talk about how memory allocators work in this class, but I did have Sashi present a few slides of user-level memory allocation in the discussion section. If you haven't actually looked at those slides, or if you didn't go to the discussion section, I had posted those slides here. Right, so, and I'm going to talk a little bit about all of that again. So make sure you go and review that material if you haven't done so already. Okay, so now what is this project about? So basically, what you're supposed to do is write a library to do memory allocation, which would be a replacement for what libmalloc does in C and C++. Okay, so you have your applications. Okay, this would be your C or C++ applications. They basically call functions like alloc and new and free. Okay. Now, typically what happens is that you link this library. Okay, so these calls actually come to this library. What the library is doing is it's managing a pool of memory on behalf of this application. So there's an OS here. This is your library. And this is your application. So when you make alloc and new calls, this library has kept track of some pages it has allocated. Okay? It's requested from the operating system, and it is carving out these pages and handing out smaller chunks of memory to the application. So if you call malloc and ask for, let's say, 32 bytes, okay, what this would do is it will take a page, it will find a 32 byte chunk that's available, and return a pointer to this page as the return value of malloc. And that's the object that you've just allocated, and you can do whatever you want. So all of these pages live on the heap. Yeah, this is what a heap does. You're dynamically allocating and deallocating memory. So the size of this memory can grow and shrink just as you allocate and free objects. Okay. Now, our goal in this project is to write a drop-in replacement for libmalloc. Okay, rather than using the standard malloc, the goal is to write one of our own. And then what does this malloc have to do? Okay, so obviously it has to intercept all of these calls, and and actually make this memory allocation decision. So we already gave you a shim layer that's going to intercept this and forward it to your library. Okay, that's already provided to you. You just use it out of the box. You don't even have to understand what it does. Okay. Now what does this malloc do? What it has to do is every time a new call comes in, it has to make sure that it has memory to allocate for that call. So let's suppose this is the first time your application does malloc. So then you call the OS and request a new page because you have not yet allocated any memory. So you get the first page. Okay. So each page will have a header, and I'll talk about this header. It's called the BBOP header, which stands for a big bag of pages. Okay, that's what the header is. The header has information about what's contained in the page. Okay, but let's suppose you allocate a page. Okay. So then what you do is you carve this page out into some number of chunks. And let's say the first malloc asks for 32 bytes. So there's a 32 byte chunk. You'll just allocate this chunk to that call and return a pointer. Okay. And the application will go and do whatever it wants to do with it. Okay. And then if it frees it, then you have to go and free this chunk. That's at the conceptual level what this library has to do. Now let's look at some details. Okay. So this heap that this malloc library is going to maintain is basically a set of pages. Okay, that you have. And you use this function called mmap and munmap to allocate and delete pages from the operating system, okay, as was pointed out. Okay, so each page has a header that contains information about what is in the page, and header also allows you to link these pages as a doubly linked list. Okay. Now there are some simplifications we asked you to do. One is, we will assume that each page will have a fixed size object. Okay, typically a malloc library can put objects of different sizes in a page, but in this case we said you assume that once you allocate an object from the page, all other objects have to be of that size. Okay, and we restrict objects to be some powers of 2. Okay, so you can have a page can have 8 byte objects, 32 bytes, 64, 128, 256, 512 and 1024. Okay. So objects in your library can be of this size. So if you do a malloc on an arbitrary size, round it to the next power of 2 and allocate an object from a page that has objects of that size. That's what you're supposed to do. Okay. So that's one thing. So now the other thing is, for each of these objects you will keep this doubly linked list. So for 8 byte objects you have currently a list of all the pages, and for 32 byte you have all the pages that contain 32 byte objects and so on.
Question.
Yes.
Can it be 4 or size 2? Is the minimum one 8?
Minimum is 8. Okay, so if you ask for, let's say, malloc of 1, you will at least allocate 8 byte objects. Don't do 4 bytes or anything like that. Okay, start with 8 byte objects. Yes.
What's the purpose of it being doubly linked list?
What's the purpose of it?
Why would it be just single linked?
Could be singly linked, doesn't matter.
Okay.
Okay, that's just a data structure we have defined. Now we don't need it in some sense to be doubly linked. It could be a singly linked list. Okay. Alright. So the data structure your library has to maintain is two lists. One is let's call it a free list, and the other one is used list. Okay. And one for each size. So anything on the free list are all the pages that you have allocated that have at least one more chunk that you can hand out, meaning it has at least one chunk free that you can allocate. Okay. Once a page is completely used up, you move it to the used list for that size. Okay. So just to give you an example, let's just take 8 bytes. Let's just ignore for the moment all the other objects. Let's suppose you are only allocating 8 byte pages. Okay. So the first time you allocate a page, it will be on the free list because you would have only allocated 8 bytes of that page, and this is a 4K page. The rest of it is free. Okay, so there are other chunks you can allocate. Okay, so it will be on the free list. So as you go through a number of mallocs, you will hand out chunks from this page. Eventually all these chunks would be handed out to the application. At that point you move this page from the free list to the use list. The page is on the use list if all of its chunks have been allocated to the program. Okay. Now the moment if it's on the use list and you do a free of one of those chunks, it has to come back to the free list because you freed that chunk. Okay? Yes, question.
So you need a free list and a use list, or each
for each size. So there will be actually 9 of these. I'll talk about that.
So pre-listening is worth of 8, pre-listening is worth of 32.
For 32 byte objects, 64, 128, 256, 512, 1024, and then anything above 1024. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven.
Eight, six,
oh, sorry. Yes. I missed one there.
So it'll be 18
plus. 18 plus 1. Sorry, not 18. It will be, you don't need, for larger objects, you don't have a free list. You'll only, I'll talk about large objects. That's a special case. You don't need both a free and a lock. You'll just need one list.
And just, if you're giving away memory, and like say there's only like, say it was originally like 64 and there's 8 bytes left.
Mm-hmm.
Does that get moved into the free list for 8 bytes and you don't need 8 bytes left?
No. Each page only has chunks of that size.
Oh.
It doesn't matter. Once you start allocating 64 byte objects, if you have 8 bytes remaining at the end for any reason, you waste. You will waste things rather than mix objects of different sizes in a page. Okay, that's the idea. Okay, yes, question there. Do you need a full list?
Yeah, you actually need it. Couldn't it just float around in space, and then when someone wants to free their pointer, you look inside the header and see if it was full, and then move to free?
You could do that. I mean, technically, because you know when you do free, you know what to do. Now, the only problem is, yeah, you could do that. I mean, but I think it's better to just do it as we suggested. Because you obviously if you do a free and it's on that page, you can get to that page from the free and then just go ahead and free it, right? So that's absolutely true. But just for simplicity, just put it in the use list for now. Okay? Alright, so each page has a bebop header. Okay? This is the header and there's a header file that tells you what is in this header. So you should have figured that out already, but let me just show you what is. Okay, so that's the header. Okay, so it has object size that tells you what size objects are you allocating. So this could be one of these, 8, 16, 32. Okay, and then you have, this is the doubly linked list, the previous and the next pointer. This is the number of available chunks you have in that. Okay, so the way you do this is you basically say 4K minus size of the header, okay, bebop header. That's the amount of memory you can actually allocate. Okay, so this is the header, takes up some space on the 4K. This is the amount of memory you can allocate. So you divide this by the object size. Okay, one of these. So you divide this by the object size that you have chosen for. That tells you how many chunks you can allocate. Okay, that's the number of available things when you have nothing allocated on that page. Okay, and as you allocate chunks, you have to keep subtracting. Okay, in addition, there is a free list for each page. Okay, this is important to understand what this is. Okay, so let's again assume it's 8 byte chunk, so you have partitioned this into 8 bytes, right? So 8 bytes, 8 bytes, and so on. And there will be some number of these. Okay, the free list is supposed to chain all of the chunks that are not allocated to any application. Okay, so it's a linked list. Okay, so let's suppose you just did the first malloc and this is the chunk that is in use, the rest are in free. Rest are free. So the free list should point to this first chunk. In this first chunk you put the pointer to the second chunk. In the second chunk you chain them, so on. Okay? So the next time you want to allocate an 8 byte object, you just go to the head of the list, find the first chunk that you need to allocate, return that pointer and then point the free list to the next one. Okay? So this is just a linked list of all of the chunks that are free and available. Is this clear? Okay, this information is kept in the page itself. You don't need to keep this externally. Right, is this clear what I just said? So the head of the pointer points to the first chunk. In the first chunk itself, you store the pointer to the next chunk and so on. And as you free them, you just add to this chunk, to this free list, and as you allocate, you just remove objects from this. Okay? So that's the basic idea behind what is in the page itself. Okay, once you use up a page, you can allocate another page to allocate more 8 byte chunks and so on and so forth. Okay, that's the basic idea. The only special case is objects greater than 1024. Okay. So in this case, what you do is you basically, if you get a malloc call that's asking for more than 1024, round it to the next 4K or just do allocate those pages contiguously as has been pointed out using mmap. Okay, so you might say I want 2048 bytes, or rather let's say 5000 bytes, okay, which is greater than 4000. So you will allocate two contiguous pages. Okay, stick a bbop header here. Okay, and just allocate this space contiguously and return a pointer back to the application. Okay. It's better to round it up, but you could just ask for that. It still does that anyway internally. Okay. I think that either one is going to work. Okay, yes, question. Oops, sorry.
What if you were memory efficient and then you just ask for whatever the request size or plus size of bbop header?
Yeah, so you could do that, but internally it may allocate you multiples of pages anyway, but that's so you could always ask for requested size plus size of bbop header just for simplicity. If the internal implementation is optimized to do something, you luck out, but in most cases it just gives you multiples of pages anyway. So it doesn't matter what you do, either one is okay. So in this case there is no free list, because you just allocate these pages, and even if there is memory left over, you don't touch it. Okay? So you just need to keep one list for all objects greater than 1024. And when you free it, you just free the whole chunk. Okay? Yes, question. Where is it?
Yeah.
Yes, so if you go into the project 3 directory on the EdLab, there are two test cases I put there. There's allocator.h and there's this library that is your shim library that intercepts these calls and calls your allocator. Okay, so yes, yeah. Question.
Okay,
I'll show you.
Try to find pointers that are valid pointers. How would you go about doing that? Because if we have it in a linked list, and we have to do it constant time.
Yes.
Then.
So you are saying if I did a free, how do you figure out where the object is? Is that the question? What's your question?
I know the TA, you know, had us AND the address with the last three bits max.
Yes.
Or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Which will give us to the bbop header, but in a large list, if we were to do that, so we have two pages. It's not going to give us...
In this one, you mean, yeah, when you have greater than 1024.
If we run that, it's going to point to like the middle of the page.
Right? No, because if you actually did it right, you would have freed this, right? This would be what you returned. So let's say you have... Let me just draw this again. Let's say you allocated 5,000 bytes. So this is your bbop header. And this is your 5,000 byte object. Okay, and there's some wasted space here. Okay. What you returned is a pointer that points to this memory address. This is page 1. This is page 2. Okay. So when you free it, you are always getting a pointer that points to the object in the first of those contiguous pages. So when you do that bit masking, it still gets you back to the bbop header.
Okay, so say someone's stupid and decides to write the program to return a pointer that's beyond that.
Yep. Program crashes. This is why you get segmentation faults.
Yeah.
So your program can crash. That's a valid response. If the user calls, let's say he basically gives you this pointer and you try to free it, program is going to malfunction and crash. This is precisely why all this pointer arithmetic causes all sorts of crashes.
Yeah, so we have to test for those conditions, right?
You don't have to. You can, but if you do a free on an invalid pointer, program crash is a valid thing to do. It's a valid end result of that call. Now you could of course check and return an error saying the free returns an error, but that's okay. Yes, question there.
What's the source for libshim?
Oh, source. It's not there. If you need to do it on a different platform, I have to give it to you. Okay, so that's, just let me know. There was some question. Yes, there's another question there. Yeah.
Do we need to zero out the memory before we give it out to malloc?
Yeah. Do you need to zero it out? You don't have to because you are doing this, let me show you. So you are actually opening a file called /dev/0 and all the malloc mmap calls actually use that file descriptor here. Because /dev/0 basically returns you a bunch of zeros. So if you read from that file, any memory that you allocate will be zeroed out automatically. So you don't need to worry about it.
We'll say a page gets written to from a few mallocs, you give it out, people write whatever, and then they free. So now you have an empty page, but it has a bunch of data on it.
Yeah, you don't need to worry about it because the malloc works on a per address space basis. So your malloc is only working for your program. So you cannot actually look at memory that belongs to other programs. But heap is a per address space data structure. So in the worst case, you can read your own data, but then who cares? That's not a security risk. If you could read some other program data, that's a security risk.
Well, right. But what I mean is you have a 1K object.
Yes.
And someone mounts that some program. They write a bunch of data into it, and they free it.
Yes.
It goes back into your page as a free object. And then, so because that can create free objects, someone else mounts another program, mounts that again,
mm-hmm.
and then it would have all that old
data in it. So you're talking about this free here, not when you allocate, but when you actually return it, when you do an unmap, do you have to zero it? Is that your question?
But it's mount free mount.
Yes. Malloc free malloc is not a problem. If you're talking about large pages, not small objects. Is that what you're asking? I mean, what?
I think he's talking about when you actually put something back onto the free list. Say you have a poll.
If you put something back onto the free list and you allocate again, this is not a problem because you're only allocating memory for your own process. This is not an issue at all. Don't have to zero it out because there will be something in there and your own process would have actually freed that thing, so it's fine for you to read it again. Okay, so don't worry about that. Any other questions? Okay, so is this clear? So now bigger issue is how are people doing this project?
It's not really, meeting the objective for me. I'm spending more time re-implementing the next list.
Okay, what objective of what? How to do memory allocation?
Of the assignments.
Why are you re-implementing things? Is there, did your program not meet the timing issue? Or?
No, I mean, we have to implement linked lists, the script to implement linked lists, or the debug header list.
Right.
And then we have to debug, basically that's going to take a long time.
Yeah, but that's what you have to do, and if you write a kernel, you don't get nice libraries that you can draw upon, right? So exactly what you have to do. The same thing is true here. You cannot draw upon STL. If you had STL, a lot of this magic would happen. You would have a linked list and all that kind of stuff. But you don't have that luxury in the kernel. Kernel has to do everything on its own, which is somewhat similar. Now, you don't have to do everything on your own, but it's kind of the stuff you have to do, which is you cannot use other people's abstractions. You have to implement your own. That's the fact of life. Now, it may be time consuming, which I completely agree, but that's the downside of doing.
But we're not thinking about memory allocation at all. We're just basically thinking about how to do it right now.
Well, that's true. That is a fair characterization, but I would say the devil is in the details many times. It's absolutely true. Yes.
I was just wondering how to work between integers and size C, because I was kind of confused with size C.
I think size T is unsigned int or something like that. I believe it's an unsigned int.
All the normal integer operations with it, right?
Yeah, you should. So long as your integer doesn't go negative, because it's unsigned. What was, somebody said something. Yes.
Can you go over just a little bit more on how to get the address of the next free list, or working on the free list?
Okay.
How to get the address inserted into
Oh, the free list inside the bebop header?
Yeah, inside the bebop header.
Okay.
How to write and read or change the...
Okay. So there is a reason why this is 8 bytes, you will see, and not 1 or 2 bytes, which is directly related to the free list. Okay. Alright, so this is bebop header. Yeah, so what are some objects there? So your object size, next, previous, and there's a free list here. Okay, so let's suppose these are 8 byte objects. Okay, so you have these 8 byte chunks. So, okay, now here, let's say this is a page that goes from so let's say that's the memory address of the page. Okay. So now assume that this is actually allocated by the first malloc call. These chunks are all free. Okay. So free list has to is a pointer. It's a pointer. It's actually a char star. Free object star, which is basically a char star. I believe it's type def there. Okay. So this thing should point to this memory address. Okay, which is what, 4096, I think this is 32 bytes or 24 bytes, I cannot remember. This is another 8 bytes. So you add this up, that's the memory address of this location. So this should point to this memory location. Okay. In here, so this is an unallocated chunk, so we can do whatever we want with it. So what we are going to do is put another free list pointer in here. Okay. So this pointer here, okay, should point to the next chunk, which is, this should point here. So this would be, that you would actually store an address here, which would be something like 4122 or something like that. Okay. So and then this is another object which is unallocated. So we are actually going to store the address of the next unallocated object in this object itself. Okay. So here you store the address of the next one, and here you store the address of the next one, and so on. Okay. And this is precisely the reason why objects have to be at least 8 bytes, because this unallocated object needs to store a pointer. So if you make it 1 byte, you can't store a pointer in 1 byte. So that's why we said the minimum chunk you have to allocate is 8 byte, because in the unallocated case, that 8 byte unallocated object actually stores a pointer. It points to the next unallocated object in that page. Okay. Now if a new malloc call comes in for an 8 byte object, all you have to do is go to the free list. So assume that there is at least one available. Okay. Otherwise it wouldn't be on the, so you go to the free list, you pick this chunk out and you return it and just have free list. So take this pointer and put it here. So basically this just starts pointing here instead of here, and this becomes allocated. That's all. Okay. And when you free something, you just, so suppose this is freed up, all you do is take this pointer, you put it here, so this one points here, and take this address and you stick it there, so it points here. So always add or remove stuff from the head for efficiency. Yes.
So if you want to point to the next page,
this thing will not point to the next page. This is going to have a pointer to the next page here. The free list only change things within that page.
So
it does not go across pages.
What's going to have a pointer to the next page? Then?
The bebop header is a doubly linked list. Right, so this will basically have another page here, so this will have a pointer to the next page, and this will have its own free list. Each page has its own free list, so free list shouldn't go across pages. That would be a problem.
The bebop header will have a pointer to the next page, but also the first chunk in free list. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it will have the first chunk of the free list, which is this. It will have previous next pointer. So this, just look at this header, you will see all the stuff that you keep there. Yes, other questions here.
So set the address. I know he has already given us the dereferencing the casting to a double pointer. So would we just have that set equal to?
So this is, think of this as a linked list. You don't really have to. So this is a linked list of free chunks.
I get the concept, it's the implementation.
Okay, so what about it? So tell me what the problem is.
So, like, how to assign that memory chunk, the address.
This chunk? So let's say your free list. Let's call it P. Okay, that's this thing. Okay? So you have initialized this to the first chunk. So when you started, you will say P is whatever this. Let's call this address 4132 just for simplicity. Okay, so P will have this value. Okay. Now, inside P, so what you have to do is you will basically dereference P. Okay, that will allow you to go there. And in there, you write the address of the next chunk. So what you will do is star P will become 4140. Which is the next thing. So what this, when you dereference this, you go to this memory location and you just write the address of the next one. So star P equals that will write this here. Okay. And then you basically just reassign P is 4140. And then if you do again star P, and then you say 4148, so then the next location will have, you will write that address. It points there. So if you dereference the pointer, you go to that memory location, you just write out a value there that writes it out. That's the way you do it.
But they're all characters, all right?
They are character pointers, char stars, not characters.
Okay, character pointers.
Free object star. Free object is char, so this is essentially a char star. It's a pointer.
So if it's a pointer to a character, it always points to the first character. Right?
Yeah, that's all you want, right? You're just pointing this memory location. Pointer to a character or pointer to integer is not material. All you want is the address of the first byte here. This is an 8-byte chunk. You just want the first bit, right? So that's 4140. And you know that this is an 8-byte object because you kept the object there. You see what I'm saying? All you want is, you don't need to know how large the chunk is. You just need to know where it begins. For that, a char star is enough. It shouldn't matter. Even if it was int star, it would be the same thing. Because all you would have to do is, where does the chunk begin? It begins at byte offset 4140. That's all you need to store, really. Okay? Yes, question?
You say that a pointer is 8 bytes. The reason I'm wondering is because we made...
Pointer is not 8 bytes, but on 64-bit architectures it could be. On 32-bit it would be 4 bytes, actually.
Well, the reason I'm wondering is because we implemented our free list as a double-length list, so we had 2 pointers.
Absolutely not a problem. If you are on 32-bit architectures, which you should be, unless you are working on some...
On 64-bit architecture?
Sorry?
I know on AMD64 they cooked it so that the size of it would be the same.
Yeah.
As the 32-bit. Like, I think void stars is a different
size. Yeah, so you should be okay. I don't think you're. That's a problem right now. I wouldn't worry about all of that. If you implement a doubly linked list also, you should be fine.
I mean, as long as you don't make any assumptions about the size, and you size up to wrap everything,
you're good. Yeah. Okay, any other questions? So I came back to, there are more questions. All right.
What's a good way to test our program?
What's a good way to...
Read section 3.
Okay.
And we passed the 2 test cases that we have, but we fail everything in the auto grading.
Okay. I could. So there are 2 things the auto grader is doing. I mean, the other test cases are actually longer sequences of alloc and free, malloc and free rather. And then there are a sequence of test, timing tests. It's not checking the output, but it's just checking the time your program took to do 3 mallocs and 3 free. So these are the 2 things it is doing. I believe there are about a dozen test cases. Some of those are nearly the same test cases with timing information. So first it checks whether your thing actually outputs the right thing, and then it checks on how long it took. Okay. I don't think there is any trick there. So test for large objects. Make sure that your program actually works for larger than 1024. I'm not sure the test cases actually tested for that case, that the ones that I gave you. Okay. So you test for that. Test for longer sequences of this, so you need more than one page. Because if you do 2 mallocs and 2 free, you will never have a free list with more than one page allocated. So if you have 32 or 64 byte object, do a sequence of 15-20 malloc, so you go beyond a page. So then make sure that you can allocate the next page and free it and so on. So those are the cases you should really test for. Large objects, making sure that a number of malloc that causes it to allocate another, do another mmap to allocate that page, things like that. Okay, so if you have tried all that and you don't know, you should come and talk to us and I can run the test cases manually and figure out what might have gone wrong. Okay, yes, your question.
Will they all get a task like if it's like the performance is bad, or would you say error, like?
I believe that it tries to say that you didn't pass certain timing tests, but I'm not sure what level of it's. It is not, unfortunately, not a program that I had written. I inherited it, and it has its limitations. But I can certainly characterize the test to you, meaning that I can say test cases 1 through 6, I'm not checking for timing, test cases, whatever, 7, 8, 9, whatever it is, check for timing. So at least you know if the test case failed, what was the problem. So I can give a description, not the actual test case, but description of what the test case is trying to test. So if it fails, you know at least something went wrong there. If you are having great deal of difficulty understanding what might have gone wrong, come and talk to me. As I said, I have tried to run them manually and figure things out. Okay. Any other questions here? We spent.
What is the Shim library doing as far as loading into the system?
It is basically just intercepting the malloc calls and calling this class malloc. It is just a wrapper. Think of it as a wrapper.
Wrapper for what though?
So you do not want to link
on an application that we have. Right?
Sorry? Yeah, yeah. So what you have to see is, so what you are going to do is you are going to force the compiler to use. Okay, so look at that.
Why don't prevent the LDP list stuff or work with
OSS? Okay, here. So here you are actually forcing it to link to your alloc as against the standard libmalloc.
Okay.
Yep. Right? So it shouldn't pick up libmalloc. In that case, all the malloc calls are good. So if you force it to actually link to your malloc, this is just writing a wrapper, so to the application, this looks like it's a standard malloc. That's all it is doing.
Okay. And the LDL just solves to use the local directory as the host for.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's going to be a different G++ commands to compile that A.
Different one? Okay.
Yeah.
So basically that's the point, that you want to use your malloc instead of the libmalloc, and this is forcing it to do that, and this makes it look like a standard thing, so its application works transparently with the standard header files and whatnot.
So you probably thought about that we should get linked against the
test. Exactly. Exactly. So it like makes it like a drop-in replacement for the standard malloc. Okay, any other questions on this? So I asked where are people in terms of getting the project done, and we got sidetracked. So let's come back to that.
I got one more on the part where you put a switch, a pointer to place it at the beginning of the page. You wrote the big box pointer, you call new page pointer. I don't really understand the cat thing behind that page pointer.
No, which, what are you showing? Are you talking about this thing? Okay. Where is it? Which section is it? New? What did you say?
Placement.
This thing? No. Okay.
The point of casting.
Bebop header needs to be located at the beginning of the page area that you allocated with me. Okay. It's casting that to a page pointer. Okay, what is it? Which allocates a bebop header at the page pointer address. You do not need to delete this header as m and map will. Okay, so this is just doing an allocation of the bebop header and sticking your bebop header in the beginning of the page.
No, I was wondering that just that line where it's
pointer.
Yeah.
What is the type of the page pointer?
What's the type of the page pointer? Okay. Let's look.
Is it on the header bar?
Yeah, should be. Otherwise, it will not work.
The page pointer is returned by MF.
Yeah, it's a standard. So why is it not saying? Yeah, that's what I'm trying to show. Well, it returns a void star, but it is defined. If you include the files, it is already defined. It's basically a type of a page. A pointer to a page, that's what it means. Right? So you don't need to know where are you asking where is it defined or what is it or what is your question. It's a system defined type that you wouldn't have to worry about really. You're just casting the bebop header into a page pointer and you're doing a new, so you actually get a, yeah. Basically, okay? Okay, so coming back to this, are you all on track to finish this or not? Is the bigger question. Yes.
I know for us, we've
people
been
are laughing, so I'm assuming it's not going to happen. Who is on track to finish? Let me ask you that. Maybe a smaller list. 1, 2. Three. Depends. Okay.
We've been at 5 of 12 for the last like 2 or 3 days. So I've been working out fairly consistently, trying to meet the Thursday. So
we keep it simple.
I don't know if we want to be optimism or pessimism.
Always be optimistic, but never be pessimistic. All right, so I am going to give you the same deal I gave last time. Okay, if you turn it on time, bonus. If you don't turn it on time, well, I mean, really, we don't have us that much time because the next assignment has to be handed out. But bigger issue is Thanksgiving break is coming up, and if you are going to be away, I can't have it be due the week after Thanksgiving. That's too late. So I can give you, Thanksgiving break. If you really want to put in the cycles and turn it in, fine by me. I mean, I am myself not going to be around, so it's not going to get graded until after that. A week
next Thursday.
Yeah. You can actually turn it in on Sunday. It doesn't make any difference. I am actually not going to be in town next week, to Wednesday through Sunday.
So next Sunday.
If you turn it in on time, you get a bonus. So if you want that much more time, then I have to make sure. Yeah. Auto grader is not taking vacation. It's going to be here. So if you want to turn it in next week is fine. I mean, I don't try to turn it in on time. If you are actually on track, so you can actually bump your grade up a little bit because you put in the cycles and you should be rewarded for it. If the rest of you are working hard and need a little more time, I will give you that extra time. So make sure you finish next week. And remember that the last programming assignment I'm going to hand out, this will not be the last one, is not auto-graded. Okay, so whether it's good or bad, you can tell me later because that one will be due the last day of class. Yeah, because we cannot really have it be due after finals or something like that. So we don't have any flexibility for the last one because we have basically just slotted it in the last 2 weeks. Okay? If you finish early, you can get to work on the next project. So, I mean, that one shouldn't be that involved, but still, okay, we'll see. Is that okay? Make it due next week. But there is a homework due on Tuesday, remember that. We said that the homework will be due after the project, and I made it due on Tuesday.
It's due Tuesday?
Yes.
Just hand it in before we go home.
Yes. Okay, so you could just do the homework now and just work on the project if you want. Alright, so let's move on. So quick, alright, so I said I will review semaphores. Okay, so I'm going to go back to lecture 9 and spend maybe 20 minutes talking about semaphores again, because people didn't really understand this concept in the test. Okay, so as we said, semaphores are a synchronization primitive. Okay, they are a generalization of locks. Okay, so what is a semaphore? So semaphore is basically an integer variable. Okay, and you can update this integer variable using two special operations. You cannot directly add or subtract to it, but you can modify it, increment or decrement it using two atomic operations, okay, a signal and a weight, as we will see. Okay, there are two types of semaphores. A binary semaphore, or what's called a mutex semaphore, is essentially equivalent to a lock. Okay, so it does exactly what a lock does. There's no difference, as we will see. Okay, it guarantees mutually exclusive access to a resource. The reason it's called a binary semaphore is this integer can only take values of 0 and 1. Okay, so as a binary variable. Okay, and just as you initialize a lock to free at the beginning of the program, a binary semaphore is initialized to 1. Okay, initializing it 1 is equivalent to saying this semaphore is free. Okay, and then if you do a wait on the semaphore, that's equivalent to an acquire, and it tries to get the semaphore. Okay, and when you do a signal, you release the semaphore. So that's exactly the same as what a lock does. Okay, now the place where you generalize the semaphore is what is called a counting semaphore. Okay, this is useful when a lock protects a single resource. Okay, so if you have multiple instances of a resource, let's say you have n instances of a resource, and you want to grab any one of them, but you don't necessarily care which one, then counting semaphores are the way to go. Rather than declaring n locks, you basically declare one counting semaphore that allows you to guard n resources. Okay? So it's useful when there are multiple instances of a resource. And this is also an integer, but here you will initialize it to n, where n is the number of resources you are trying to protect. Okay? And again, you do the same thing. There are two operations, a wait and a signal. A wait allows you to do an equivalent of an acquire. A signal allows you to do the equivalent of a release. Okay? This is the basic concept, and we'll look at some examples of how to use semaphores. Is this clear? The two types of semaphores. Okay? And we'll see a third use of a semaphore. Okay? So here, both of these cases, a mutex semaphore or a counting semaphore, the semaphore is acting as a lock. Okay? It's allowing you access to a critical section. A third use of a semaphore is in what is called scheduling. Okay? This allows you to control the order in which threads execute. Okay? And that was basically the question on the test, as you will see. And we'll see examples of where we had looked at that aspect in class as well. Okay, so here is what I just said. So the way you use semaphore is you'll do semaphore.wait. That allows you to acquire the semaphore. You have the critical section, you do semaphore.signal. This is equivalent to putting a lock acquire here and a lock release here. This is a use of a binary semaphore. Okay? You use the counting semaphore exactly the same way, except that you would initialize it to n. Okay? So what happens when you do a wait? Basically, wait decrements the semaphore. Okay? If the semaphore value is non-zero, the wait just continues. It's like the lock just went through without blocking. If the semaphore value, when you try to decrement it, has already reached 0, then you are going to block. Okay? This means that if the semaphore value is 0, semaphore is not available, so you have to block until some other thread does a signal and frees the semaphore. Okay? And signal just basically checks the wait queue of the semaphore. If there is a thread blocks, it wakes it up. If not, it goes and increments the semaphore. Yes, from 0 to 1. Or 1 to some other value. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. So it's basically equivalent to signal element. Here is too much milk problem using some locks, where you did a lock acquire, if no milk, buy milk, you did a lock release. Okay, this is the same thing using semaphore. So instead of lock acquire, you have lock semaphore wait. Instead of lock release, you have semaphore signal. Exactly the same code. In this case, you are using the semaphore as a binary semaphore, which, as I said, is the same as a lock. Okay? Now let's look at other uses. Okay, so here is actually an implementation of the semaphore class. Okay, so what are the things? So there are two methods, wait and signal. Okay, so you can either do a wait or a signal to modify the semaphore. You have the value of the semaphore, is it free or not, and you have a queue of threads or processes that may be blocked on the semaphore. This is how a semaphore may be internally implemented by a semaphore library, okay, such as pthreads. Okay. You initialize it with some value, if this is a binary semaphore, you'll initialize it as 1. If it's a counting semaphore, you'll initialize it as n. And if it's scheduling, you will initialize it as 0, as we'll see. Initially, the queue is empty. So that's what wait does. Wait decrements the value. If the value is negative, then you know that the semaphore is not available, and you will basically make the process block. Okay? If the value is greater than 0, then basically you know, or greater than or equal to 0, you know that the semaphore was available, so wait will just return. Okay? And when you do a signal, you increment the value, and if there is some process on the queue, you unblock that process, saying somebody has just released the semaphore, go ahead and acquire it. Okay. Yes, your question here.
So essentially, if we were to take this implementation and use, writing in C++, we'd have to use blocks to make the semaphore wait process the signal atomic, correct?
You would not, you want to use locks to implement semaphores. You will actually use test and set instructions to implement. Just as we implemented locks, which I think is on the same slide here. So this was an implementation of a lock. You use a test and set guard == 1. So you use hardware primitives to implement locks. You use the same hardware primitives to implement semaphore. You will do exactly this in lock semaphore release. You will do while test and set guard == 1. You will do a spin lock. The queue is not empty. You will do all of these things. Okay, so just take this code and plug it in here. Okay, because I just said this must be atomic, because I assumed that we'll just use those ideas and plug them in here. You don't want to use locks to implement a semaphore, because semaphores are just a low level primitives as lock. So you want to use hardware support to implement them. Either you will use masking of interrupts, or you will use test and set instruction. We saw how to do both for locks. Okay, so this was test and set, and in lecture 8 we saw how to use locks using masking interrupts. Same thing you will use for this this implementation, exactly the same. Okay, any other questions here? Okay, so here was an example which I am basically going to ignore, but as you will see, what happens is these are processes that are just doing signal and wait. Initial values to queue is empty. P1 and P2 are executing. P1 does wait. Okay, this brings the value to 1. Okay, it's still non-zero. P1 continues to execute. You do another wait. Okay, that goes to 0. Still fine. Okay, at that point, you continue to execute. Any further waits require you to block. Okay, so the first two waits will go through. The third wait will cause this P1 process to block. Okay, queue will have P1. Okay, eventually P2 will do a signal. Okay, then P1 will get unblocked, continue execution. Okay, and then they will do signal and the value will go back to 2 at the end of this. Okay, so this is an example of a counting semaphore. Okay, because you initialized it to 2, you can cause do 2 acquires before anything blocks. If you initialize it to n successive acquires will succeed without causing the process to block. And you need n instances of some resource, as we will see in just a second. Okay. So here is where the third use of semaphores, which is to do scheduling, and this was exactly what we had asked on the test. So the mutual exclusion you already know. You can use it either as a binary semaphore or a counting semaphore. But here is how you can use semaphores to do scheduling. This is where semaphores actually differ from locks. Okay, this is not something locks will allow you to do. Yes, question there. Technically you could do that, but you are basically trying to emulate what semaphores do using locks. You are right. If you can actually initialize the lock to be not free when you begin, okay, then you could certainly do that. Typically when you declare a lock, it's automatically initialized to free. But when you declare a semaphore, you're supposed to give the initialization value, which a typical lock implementation will not allow you to do, because it's assumed that when you start off, the lock is always free. Semaphores are just an integer, you specify the value. But if you could say the lock, when you start off, the lock is not free, for example, you could do something like that.
Is that because one thread can't unlock another thread?
No, you could. There is no difference at all. I'm just telling you the way people use locks, you don't start off with the lock being not free. But semaphores don't have that restriction. It's an integer value, so it can go anywhere from 0 to n. So by initializing it to a specific value, in this case 0, you can do something different. Okay? So if you want to use semaphores to do scheduling, what you do is you initialize it to 0, which basically means when you start off the process or your application, the semaphore is not available. Okay, it's basically not available to anyone. If you added 1 or n, it was available. So at this point, the first wait actually blocks. Okay, because the first wait goes and sees that the value is 0 and it blocks, as you see in the previous implementation here. Okay. When you do a wait, you decrement the value, but already had it to 0. So first time you call wait, it becomes minus 1, and then the value is less than 0, you will block. Okay, that's the semantics of a wait. So here, if you actually do a wait, you will block. And now some other thread has to do a signal for you to unblock. Okay, this is how two threads can control how they execute. Okay, this is also an important, as I had mentioned last time, this is also an important difference. Difference between critical section and scheduling constraint is who does the wait and who does the signal. Sorry, what was the question? No, this is not stream or flow. So here, in any mutual exclusion or a critical section type application or semaphore, the same thread is going to do a wait, then you have the critical section, and the same thread is going to do a signal. Okay, this is the same thread, let's call it T1. In the case of scheduling, the signal and the wait are being done in two different threads. Okay, so as we'll see an example here, T1 does s dot wait, this blocks, okay, is waiting for something. Some T2 comes along later, it does the same, takes the same semaphore and does a signal which causes this thread to be unblocked. Okay, so in case of scheduling, the wait and the signal are appearing in two different threads. In case of critical section, the wait and the signal are actually in the same thread. They are executed by the same thread. Okay? This is something to keep in mind. Okay? So you understand how we are using semaphores to do signaling. You have started by initializing the semaphore to be not free. So the first thread that calls it is just going to block. Okay? And then some other thread can come along and then do a signal and then cause the thread to be unblocked. Okay? So this is how you can control execution of. Yes, you have a question there.
So, in a way, what is it that keeps wait from returning execution until it's ready?
What keeps wait from causing it to execute?
So you've got some impulse wait. So, that can be delayed.
And then if it's less than zero, you block.
Right, so how does it block? What's block doing?
What does block doing? It's actually adding the thread to the wait queue of the semaphore.
Okay. So
there's a queue here. The semaphore implementation has a queue of threads. This is a queue of threads or queue of processes. So the internal implementation will take that thread and just put it on the wait queue.
So whenever you're using a semaphore, in a sense, the semaphore class itself is what's driving the program.
Yes, exactly.
So you need to code to any interface that the parallel.
Well, the application is coding to wait and signal, but the implementation of the semaphore class is actually has to do these low-level things that cause the thread to block.
Right, because I think wake up, that's just this call right there.
Yes. Well, this is pseudocode. No, don't assume that. Yeah.
Like the particular syscall in that.
Yes.
And block is going to be also syscall.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So like it's like PRS signal.
Okay. Thank you. Alright, so here is producers and consumers, again our standard implementation. So, before I actually do this, so this should make it clear how you take turns in your, in that question on the exam. Right, so because we have three of these guys, right? So you have you, friend 1, and friend 2. Okay? So if you want to take turns, you basically do a wait, and then you do you need 3 semaphores. Okay, so you do F1 dot wait. So here you block, and when this guy does signal, you wake up. Two dot wait. So you do a wait, Okay, initially if this is free, then you continue, and then these two guys are blocked, and then at the end of this you do a signal, so this thread wakes up. Okay, because this is basically, this one was F1 was set to 0 and F2 was set to 0. These are semaphores, so you are blocked. Both F1 threads, F1 and F2 are blocked. So when F1 is signaled, you, this one wakes up, it does whatever, it goes buys milk, and then it does F2 signal that causes this to wake up, and then it does me signal. So each thread takes turn in this fashion. Okay. This is again what we did in producers and consumer. Okay. So that's exactly what you do, full weight and full signal are doing exactly this. So in producers and consumer, just one second. If the consumer starts off first, there is no data item to consume, it has to block. So we are using a semaphore to do precisely that. So you have this full semaphore that's initialized to zero. So the first consumer that goes, basically goes and does wait and just blocks there. Okay. After the producer has produced his data item, the last thing it does is does a signal to wake up a consumer saying that there is a data item I have produced, go ahead and consume it. So this is how producers and consumers also use scheduling, because the consumers have to block if there's nothing to produce. Similarly, the producers will have to block if the entire buffer is full. If the buffer is full, so that's the empty semaphore, which causes the, so first thing that the producer does is empty wait. If all the slots are used up, then you have to block. Yes, you have a question there. Okay. Yeah, so you will see that in this case, these are two different threads. There's a consumer thread and a producer thread, and you are using scheduling to do precisely that. You are also using a counting semaphore. Okay, this is counting semaphore is guarding these n slots. Okay, so long as any slot is available, a producer or consumer can either consume or produce. But if they're all full, producers are to wait. If they're all empty, consumers are to wait. So this is one application that shows all the different uses. So here is a binary semaphore. This is a counting semaphore, this is a semaphore used for scheduling. So it actually nicely comes together in this case. So this is the thing you should really understand, so how things are being used. Okay? Any questions on semaphores? I have one more slide. This is something I had not presented last time, but somebody had asked saying, how do we actually use it in real application? So POSIX has a semaphore implementation. Okay, just as you use pthread, mutex and condition variables and whatnot, you have semaphore declared in POSIX, so you have to include semaphore.h, and here are the calls. Okay, to declare a new semaphore, you basically do an init that returns a semaphore type, okay, and then you can do wait and signal. Okay, this is the initialization value. Okay, you can declare it to be 0, 1, n, that allows you to use the semaphore as a binary semaphore, counting semaphore, or something that you use for scheduling. Okay. So everything we have talked about is actually, you can just use in real programs. So you have wait and post. Post is the same as signal. Okay, there are two names for it. So here are the two calls. There's also a non-blocking wait called try wait, which we really didn't talk about, but POSIX implements it. So what this does is it basically tries to grab the semaphore or the lock, but if it is not available, it returns with an error saying semaphore is in use instead of blocking. Okay? Just think of it as a non-blocking lock acquire. You do a lock acquire, the lock is available, you block. But suppose it was not available, then it just returns saying lock is not available. Okay? So there is this extra call that POSIX implements, which we really didn't talk about, but it's there for specific purposes. Sorry? No, it shouldn't be there. I think it's... Well, I think these guys call it SEM open. On Max, which is basically the same thing. Yeah. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, so now it should be all clear. Too late, but clear. Alright, so I guess we ran out of time to do any file system stuff today, which is okay, we'll resume next time. So, quick things, homework due Tuesday, project due Thursday. If you turn it in on time, bonus. If you you don't turn it in on time, automatic extension to next week, no penalty. Okay, it's actually the same thing, but another way to think, better way to think about it. And next week we will have a class on Tuesday. So if you are in town, I think people start leaving at some point, but we will have the class. I'm not cancelling class because we are one class behind schedule. We will continue the discussion on file system. Okay? And then there's one more assignment coming after this on file system. I will put it up next week if you really want to get started early. Okay, but we will discuss it on the week, the day after, the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. That's when I'll really talk about what the project is about. It's about implementing a very small DOS-like file system. Okay, that's the last project. Based on the concepts we'll talk about on Tuesday. Okay, so let's stop here for today. And one more thing. I will hand out your projects, graded projects, so hopefully on Thursday. Okay, I was trying to get in touch with Sashi. So as I had mentioned, your grade will be whatever the auto grader gave you plus something that we will assign for effort. So if even if you did not pass some of the auto grader test, but you did 80% of what was required, then you still get some points. Okay, so this is basically manual grading and auto grading will be combined to get your final grade. Yes. You will have discussion tomorrow.